Thanks, Noel. Well, the pleasure of food is our continuing theme this week on The Good Life with me, Mark Franklin, as we continue our conversation with Dr. John Gagné, a historian who specialises in early modern Europe. The change in European tastes was what we talked about last week, and the way in which new trade routes during the Renaissance affected what people ate. The laws of food classification that governed what people could eat during Lent and other fast periods was another theme. We talked about the shift in attitudes towards food that saw people begin to start thinking about food in terms of pleasure, in much the way that the Roman philosopher Lucretius had done in antiquity. And we talked about the first cookbook ever published in the West, which was titled On Virtuous Pleasure and Good Health. A controversial title because the idea of virtuous pleasure was pretty radical at that time. This week, we resume our discussion with Dr. John Gagné to find out how Renaissance attitudes towards food have fed into our contemporary discussions about what Dr. Gagné calls mindful eating. The 16th, in the first encyclical that he wrote as Pope, talked about eros in a positive sense, the first time that any Pope has ever done that. Was that a discussion that really had its roots in the church in this time?
I don't know. In terms of sexual pleasure, I would say...
Physical pleasure.
Yeah, okay. Physical pleasure. Yes, at least in the environs of the church, let's put it that way, that I think the institutional church was not as committed to exploring the limits of pleasure in the language that these sort of subversives were. And yet this was all happening around the same time as some of these major taste shifts were happening, right? So that this book's written in the 1460s, the Americas are discovered in the 1490s. So, you know, the shifts are part of this larger 15th century story in which both the conversation is shifting, and then the materials that, you know, people are actually putting in their mouths are changing as well.
How did food consumption change? What changed?
I would say probably the most radical thing, to return to something we were talking about earlier, was the gradual absorption of American produce into the European diet over the course of this, you know, long Renaissance, which is coming to incorporate a lot of these New World products into what we now think of as the defining elements of national cuisines. Foods like tomatoes, potatoes, corn, certain forms of capsicum, those are the classic ones.
So these discussions of Lucretius and Epicureanism, it was largely a debate about whether pleasure was good for you or bad for you.
I mean, to answer that question, it was good for you. I mean, that was what this shift in the 1460s allowed people to realize, was that you could eat for pleasure and that it would have no adverse moral effects, right? The worry that pleasure in an Epicurean sense would slip you into moral decrepitude was essentially sidelined in favor of the idea that you could be healthy, you could be virtuous, and you could pursue pleasure, right? That's sort of, again, what's great about that title of that cookbook, On Virtuous Pleasure and Good Health, was that you could sort of have it all. And of course, the great thing about this cookbook from the 1460s is that it goes hot across Europe, right? So it's published, it's translated into many different languages. And so this conversation starts to trickle throughout Europe. And at least in terms of sort of the discussion about food and on an intellectual level, it means that all the possibilities are open. So I think that's where I see a connection between a sort of intellectual discussion about what's pleasurable and then what actually happens on sort of some of the elite tables around Europe, which is that there's kind of a freedom to pursue pleasure and to really celebrate it. So this is why we start to see, I think, the growth in banqueting culture, a real sort of like boom in cookbook literature. You know, the chains have been broken and people can take pleasure in things really openly and really, you know, celebrate it.
And start to enjoy food communally as well.
Sure. I mean, you know,
I mean, is this when things like dinner parties and playing music alongside the dinner table came into fashion?
I think they definitely went big. I mean, I hate to denigrate the Middle Ages because I think a lot of this was happening then as well. But the language wasn't there, right? The sort of language of doing these things in a pleasurable frame was not part of the discussion. I think it was part of a noble discussion of, you know, doing what nobles do. Whereas this, you know, after the Renaissance, it was open to a whole bunch of people. And, of course, it was still pursued by the nobility, but it was pursued by intellectuals, by, you know, more and more regular folk as well. And so, yeah, I think it definitely gave rise to sort of a spirit of actually bringing, as your question suggests, bringing the sort of intellectual and the communal together so you could come together around a table and actually have debates about things. And I think that's why a lot of Renaissance writers tend to situate their books around tables. You know, they all take place around dinner tables because they like to discuss issues around the table.
So a very egalitarian sense developed during the Renaissance, something that we might recognize today. I think a lot of people would be familiar with the idea of sitting around a table and having a conversation. You know, people meet for lunch to catch up. Is that something that was not around previously then?
I mean, if we think about where the intellectual powerhouses were, was sort of religious institutions. And many religious institutions imposed a ban of silence at the table, right? So that actually conversation was disallowed. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the opportunity for people actually to exchange ideas over tables may have something to do with sort of the secularization of intellectual exchange around tables.
I also have this vision of rowdy feasts from the Middle Ages, where people were eating all kinds of different animals and eating in abundance and drinking lots of wine. Is that not a kind of decadence as well, a kind of enjoyment of the physical?
Sure. And I don't deny for a second that there was lots of that in elite culture in the Middle Ages. But again, they're not talking about it in terms of pleasure through food. They're talking about it in terms of it as the prerogatives of the elite to pursue elite pastimes. So it has more to do with the language of nobility than it does with the language of pleasure.
The language of pleasure being the crucial thing.
Exactly.
To what extent did eating become a way of connecting to God and of taking pleasure in God's bounty?
Well, in particular, anthropologists have looked at long-standing attitudes to food that go from, you know, the 19th century way back into the Middle Ages. And they're able there to see that kind of connection, the idea that coming together, following the rhythms of nature, that you're participating in the divine plan for the universe, and that it's part of a way of consolidating community, building community, and celebrating creation.
Was abundance and excess a characteristic of Renaissance dining?
Sure, definitely. I think in some ways, what's different about the pre-modern world versus our own world is this violent shaking between having too much and not having enough. And actually, the whole religious calendar is based on that principle, right? That some days you fast and some days you feast. And that, I think that goes for most people living in the pre-modern world, is that they never really knew what was around the corner in terms of what went on the table. And so that you could have periods when, you know, you had no food and periods when you had a lot of food. So yes, dining in abundance was definitely a big part of the culture, but so as was sort of also scarcity and fear of famine too, which I think has to be balanced with it. So that there, you know, there's a lot of celebration of dining, but then there's also this really present fear of just never having enough to eat.
So it was genuinely motivated, this Epicurean idea. It wasn't just something that was used as a ruse to get the church on side, as an excuse for people to be able to enjoy food in a way they hadn't before. There was sincerity behind it?
Oh, I definitely think so. I think there was an effort to try to amalgamate some pretty interesting ideas, ideas that I think we would now consider pretty modern, right? I mean, Epicurus is still kind of like a shocking philosopher because he doesn't conform to a lot of this kind of traditional codes of morals that even now we tend to follow. So I think it was part of trying really sincerely to incorporate interesting ideas into an actual way of living that seemed completely reasonable. That's the great thing when you actually go and read Lucretius and Epicurus, is that it's totally reasonable, but it didn't fit into the way people lived at that time.
It's about moderation. It's
exactly
about enjoying things, but not in excess.
Yeah, and in fact, Epicurus himself was known to have subsisted on oats and water. So for him, it actually wasn't about superabundance, right? It was about just taking pleasure and having enough to eat.
Well, that's why I was wondering whether the use of Epicurus hadn't been a ruse by people during the Renaissance, because Epicurus was about moderation. And I thought that perhaps if people during the Renaissance were going beyond moderation towards abundance, then maybe they were actually taking this kind of idea of physical pleasure to the nth degree and just using Epicurus as a way to justify it to the church.
I mean, I think it is possible, but I don't think that's what was happening. I think what was happening was that there was a genuine desire to try to figure out how Epicurus worked. And I think the fact that, if we go back to that cookbook we've been talking about, that it really was about good health too and about virtue, that it meant that there was a genuine effort to try to incorporate all of these components into a holistic worldview.
It's something that's still relevant today. I mean, debates about whether pleasure is good for you or bad for you, perhaps we've moved on from there, but certainly you talk about this as a precursor to discussions about mindful eating. Before we go into that, how would you describe mindful eating?
Well, mindful eating, I mean, what I had in mind when I was mentioning that was particularly, what you think about in terms of yourself, in terms of your community, in terms of the world when you actually sit down to table. And nowadays we think about it in terms of, is this going to be good for me in terms of health? Where is this coming from in terms of ecological questions? How does this relate to the global food systems? And I think that's what I was trying to point to in talking about this move towards Lucretianism, because what was important about it was that it was a moral attitude to food, right? It was about moral questions, but also centered around the table, right? So it wasn't just about whether it was good or bad for you in a purely instrumental health sense. It was about, how does this fit into my relationship to the world and the relationship to God? How does it fit into the way I think of myself as an eater? So I think this is really a beginning point in terms of contemporary attitudes to mindful eating, is making food a moral consideration and making dining a moral discussion.
Is this what made you want to look at food in the Renaissance? It seems like a slightly obscure topic, but I mean, why is it relevant to today?
Many of us don't think that food has a history, and yet I think that food, the history of food, is at the same time the history of the world, because it's intensely relevant, because it's something that we sit down to every day, and yet when you start to look into it, you realize that all of these fundamental questions, right, about life or death, about good and bad, about, decisions, about globalism, they all come to center around what ends up on people's plates. So I think really it's a way of getting at all of the important themes of history, but through a lens that really, allows you to almost do it in a more intimate way, to sort of put it into a personal context and also into community context.
And are you a foodie?
I don't like that word. I sort of feel like it's now it has all these connotations of being really snobby. But I think, hopefully we're all foodies now, in the sense that I think many of us are really interested in food and love to, talk about it and think about it. So, I'm a lover of food, let's say.
All right, John. Thanks very much for joining us on The Good Life.
Thank you.
Dr. John Gagne, a historian currently teaching at Sydney University, talking there about how Renaissance Europeans began to appreciate food in terms of pleasure, and also talking about the impact that has had on Western notions about food ever since.